Senate Committee on Labor, Consumer, and Business Affairs, Friday, May 11, 1979, 1 p.m., Hearing Room B. Hearing, Executive Appointment, Donald Epley, Administrator, Personnel Division, Senate Bill 870, relating to barber or hairdresser certificate display, Senate Bill 871, relating to minimum student body and hair design school. Work session, Senate Bill 392, relating to self-insurance by two or more employees, Senate Bill 496, relating to bargaining unit benefits board, Senate Bill 504, claim service coverage by workers' compensation insurers, Senate Bill 228, administrative resolution of waste claims, Senate Bill 240, relating to auto repairs.
First, we're going to consider today as a confirmation of the executive appointment of Don Epley to head the personnel division, administrator of the personnel division. We're going to ask Jim Bedingfield if he'd come up with Mr. Epley.
Are you ready to proceed, Mr. Chairman?
Right. We almost have a quorum.
We do.
Not quite.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the gentleman who sits on my right is Mr. Donald Epley, who, after a rather arduous process, has been selected for presentation to you by the executive department to fill the position of the administrator of the personnel division. As you know, the personnel division is one of those supervised by my department. I'd like to review with you for just a minute, if I may, the process through which Mr. Epley has been put. It is applied exclusively to this position by statute, so it is with no little time and effort that devoted to selecting him that he appears here today. Initially, we recruited people for this personnel position, both outside of state government and within, throughout the western United States, and received approximately 83 applications based on the specifications for the job. Those numbers were reduced to 5 by a committee selected by the PERB, as provided by law. Those 5 were then referred to us at the executive department, where we interviewed all 5 applicants. We decided that Mr. Epley was the one that we thought should have the job. The matter was referred to the governor, and he concurred in our selection after reviewing the top 5 applicants. You will see from the material that you have available that Mr. Epley has had wide experience in government and has a very substantial educational background. The last governmental unit for which he worked as an employee was the city of Oswego, Oregon, as city manager. Since that time, he has been doing consulting work with various governmental units throughout western Oregon and maybe even further than that. I'm not sure where they are all exactly. You will notice, if you will take a look at the statutes which define the requirements and limitations of this position, that it states that he shall not hold any other public office or employment. He does not presently hold any such position. We have, although he has 1 or 2 positions that by contract that have not totally expired at this time, but which are scheduled to do so in the very near future. Because of the nature of them, at the time we first contacted him, we were unable to have him arrive here at a time when those contracts had expired. They will, as I say, very quickly. We have asked for legal opinion on this, and Mr. Oliver states that he does not believe even these contracted services conflict with the statute. But just to be sure that everyone understands his status with regard to that work, which is all contractual at this time, We wanted to tell you about it ahead of time. So without any further ado, I would like to present to the committee members, Mr. Epley, who sits on my right.
Thank you. Mr. Epley, we'd like to hear from you a little about yourself. And there's one question I'd like to ask. I'm looking over your resume here, and I see that you work for the state of Wisconsin, city of Oshkosh, and village of Elk Grove, and numerous employment, and some was for a period of a year or less, and more. We'd like to know why, in getting up to your last employment, was for a short period of time. We're interested in someone that worked here for a period of, I would presume that the governor appointed you wants to fill out your term, at least.
Okay.
Could you tell why you terminated your employment so quickly? Throughout your career, it seems to me that the longest you... Four and a half years with the city of Lake Oswego, yes.
Okay, perhaps I can just tell you a little bit about myself. As you know, I was educated in Wisconsin and then later received a master's degree in public administration from the University of Kansas. My career thus far, about 15 years of public service, has been on a career track. One of the things I'm excited about with the state is it gives me an opportunity to grow professionally and use some of the skills that I've acquired as I've gone through my own career. Some of those agencies that you mentioned that I stayed a short time in were really career paths, and there are a number of good opportunities that occurred that allowed me to progress. If you'll note, back in Wisconsin, my public service was as a municipal finance officer. Really wished to pursue the city management career that I have had in Lake Oswego, and the opportunities that occurred in one case from Elk Grove was on was the move to Lake Forest. Those two are probably my shortest time periods, Elk Grove and Lake Forest. I served in Elk Grove for a year and a half, and the manager of Lake Forest had some things happening that he wanted me to work with him on to get them through a transition period. It was a pretty exciting opportunity at that time for me, and with the concurrence of the manager in Elk Grove, who was sorry to see me leave, I moved over to North Shore Community. At that point, it was pretty apparent to me that I needed a master's degree. Now, the manager that I worked for in Lake Forest happens to be a KU alumni, as I am now, and encouraged me to go ahead and go to graduate school, and that's really what caused those short time periods.
You see any conflict of interest as far as your position with the state, your appointment is concerned?
No. Mr. Bedingfield mentioned a couple of contracts I'm working on. One of them, as a matter of fact, in my own opinion, would be a little sticky for me, so I've made a transition in that particular situation under Labor Relations Services for Fire District 10 in Multnomah County that I'm performing. Last week, I brought a labor attorney to the fire board meeting with me, and we've made the transition. I have one more evening left to introduce that same attorney to our negotiating counterparts, and then I will have made that transition.
You have any questions of the committee? Senator Trove?
Can you explain the nature of these contracts so we know what you're talking about?
What I've been doing is a couple of things on a consulting basis. When I left Oswego, I looked at the kinds of things that I think I do well and offered those services. I've been doing some management training programs for a couple of different agencies. I'm now working down in a southern coast town, helping them go through their search process for a city manager. I don't think we'll put their candidates quite through the hoops that I've gone through, but we'll do a good process.
Do you have a contract then to help them do
that? Yes.
Yeah. So what's the other one?
The other one, of course, is with the fire district. Now, I only have two current, and one is with the South Coast City, which I'll be completing in a couple of weekends.
What's the fire district one?
Fire District 10 out in Multnomah County.
What do you do for them?
I've been doing their full range of labor negotiations, and we're going to do some training on contract administration as the process winds up.
labor negotiations. What do you do in labor negotiations?
Well, we not only propose to do all of their table negotiations with their IFF local, but we will do contract administration and handle grievances and what have you. Because of the nature of those and the fact that they could end up before IRB, there's no way that I can be comfortable with doing that, and that's why I said I made that transition.
So you've terminated that contract?
Yes. Well, I haven't terminated the contract per se. I've merely brought another person on board that will now do that project, and I won't be involved other than the fact that I'm the one that initiated it.
Will you be benefiting financially from the contract?
No.
No way.
I'll be paid for the work that I've done to date, and then any payments from now on will go to the labor attorney I brought on board.
Why don't you call that terminating? We're just saying it.
Fine.
That's what you've done. You have terminated the contract, in that
essence. In essence, yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you, what are your plans basically for the upper level, your associates at the highest level? Are you going to continue those people, or what's happening?
I can't honestly answer that for you. I think, like any new administrative assignment that the person takes, you have to take some time to assess weaknesses and strengths, take a look at the needs of the agency and the goals that are established over a short period of time or long period as it may be, and go from there. I have no premeditated feelings one way or the other.
I've just say this, I've heard some rumblings of problems. I was wondering if you had heard any.
Well, you know, to be quite frank, the things I've heard and the challenge as far as I'm concerned is to take that agency and make it far more palatable than it has been to the user agency.
Now, what do you mean by that? Palatable to the user agency?
Well, you know, when you get into a staff agency, and it's been my experience before, usually the line agencies are quite concerned about the enforcement and the monitoring functions that go on in the staff agency. My endeavor is to work with the line agencies and give them some benefits from this staff function called personnel.
Well, what kind of benefits?
Well, one thing that occurs to me quite quickly is to develop some good training programs that can be used and visible to the line agencies. I'll be the central clearinghouse for that. Work on some of the things that I've heard complained about. Turnaround time for appointments might be one, as an example.
What's your attitude about affirmative action?
Was my personal philosophy?
Yeah, personal philosophy.
I'm rather sorry that we have to have laws around it. I think it's something that should come naturally.
Does it come naturally?
To me?
Without the laws, do we get women into high positions, or into the positions to which they're qualified?
Obviously not, or we would not have had the laws to begin with. I'm speaking personally.
But personally, you say you regret the necessity of the law, but nonetheless, the law is there, right?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And you.
The comment that I made was only to say that, from a personal standpoint, I believe in what the law does, but wouldn't have needed the law to believe in it.
Okay. What are your plans about opening jobs up to women and minorities, handicapped, others?
Well, as I understand it, the governor has a very affirmative, very viable affirmative action person that I would like to work with, have the agency work with. Affirmative action is implemented through recruitment procedures, through upward mobility, and a number of things, and I'm assuming that the agency will play a great part in that.
Mr. Rambley, I'm still not understanding your private business, Urban Management Resources. Is that a corporation?
No, it's not. I'm just a sole proprietor that didn't even register it. As a matter of fact, it's a name I use.
And you said that you have a couple of contracts.
Right.
To provide services.
They're more agreements than written out contracts, as a matter of
fact. And you were the sole owner of that entity, business entity.
Yes. It's a consultant concept, and it was
me. Just by yourself.
Right. But the concept went beyond that, and the purpose that I established was to develop a number of resources that could be used for specific needs of clients as I produce those clients. As an example, when I talked to Fire District 10, I said that to them that there were some things that I would do for them, but not do personally, but would in fact use a labor attorney that has been in public sector labor law for a number of years to aid in the legalistic matters.
Now, what I'm confused about is that Senator Troll asked you if you were going to receive any of the benefits of these contracts, and you answered no.
What the senator asked, at least my interpretation was, would I have a financial gain after my appointment? And I said no.
Well, is it your intention to terminate Urban Management Resources if you're appointed?
Let me say this, that I will terminate those projects that I'm working on, and there's only one, and it is the fire district, that I feel and the executive department feels would be in conflict with what I'm doing as a personnel administrator.
Well, Ed, Jim, don't take this as any criticism, but the problem is that I think it's more than if you're just having a conflict. The question is whether as the personnel director and you draw a salary, that's going to be your full-time job. Or are you going to have some other business operation out here that's going to be taking your time? Now, I happen to be one of those that if we're going to pay you the salary we are, I don't think you should be spending your nights out there wearing yourself out on some other business entity. And that's what I'm trying to find out, if that's what you intend to do still.
I would like the latitude to stimulate myself as I have in the past. Now, stimulation to me before is, as I progressed through my public career, teaching school, maybe a night a week. I didn't find that to wear me out, Senator. I found it quite stimulating.
Well, I would hope that you would stay in teaching, but Urban Management Resources is something else than teaching.
All right, let me answer with another comment. I have no plan. I do not know what will transpire in the way of people seeking me out to do things for them. I am not planning on marketing myself. I'm not planning on doing the things that I did over the last 6 months. However, if a fellow manager were to call me and say, Don, can you help us with a management training program on Saturday, whatever date, and I felt that it would neither wear me out in terms of my energies to do the job that I have as my livelihood, I would like the opportunity to do that. Now, if legal counsel in the governor's office says no, that in the strictest sense of the law or whatever, that's not the thing to do, and I won't do it.
Well, let me ask you this. If another fire district comes up to you and asks Urban Management Resources to have a contract, now you have a man there to help you, are you going to contract with them again?
Well, Urban Management Resources in that sense won't exist. No, I would not. I would not. As a matter of fact, if a fire district came to me, I'd say, I know a good labor attorney you might want to talk to. And that's because I haven't known you yet, so I'm assuming your energies are taken up.
I'm afraid we're on the wrong side. I would love to do it so that I could probably have talked to myself at the bar and came up and made myself
when you get to know him.
I'm not sure that'd be fair, but all right.
Let me ask you, Mr. Epley. The Senate, as I understand it, this next week is going to have a rather comprehensive bill come to it on the floor of the Senate dealing with the state merit system. And in essence, the intent of the bill is to repeal certain aspects of the merit system as it contacts the collective bargaining process. My question, let me ask you, one, your view of collective bargaining in the public sector and specifically in the state service and your opinions of that particular bill and that particular concept.
Well, I've been involved in collective bargaining one way or another, either formally or informally, for a lot of years. I have no problem with it.
In the public sector?
Right. The only concerns that I have ever had, I think, have been the concerns to implement a council policy that said home rule was important, and I know that's been at issue for a number of years. My personal philosophy is whichever way these issues are decided, they're decided, and we do a good job with them. I'm not that familiar with Senate Bill 57. I have not read it in its entirety. I only know generally what the concept is. If I were concerned at all, it would be the concern over throwing out a merit system, assuming that a merit system actually worked in reality. Unfortunately, it doesn't always, and so perhaps this is the best way to go.
Mr. Trump, let me ask you that, like us, the city of Lake Oswego, you were the city manager there for approximately, a little over 4 years?
4.5.
And are there labor organizations that represent the city employees in the city of Lake Oswego?
Yes.
In a very candid appraisal, what organizations are those?
IFF for the firefighters and Teamsters for the police, which was new, and an employees association for almost all the other employees.
Was it an in-house organization,
yes.
Employee organization for the rest of the staff?
Yes.
If, in fact, the firefighters and the Teamsters, the people who dealt with you would have come down, would come down here to testify, very candid appraisal.
Mm-hmm.
Other than the difference philosophically, mm-hmm. What do you think their judgment of your handling of their labor relations would have been?
I think the Teamsters, because it was a pretty new situation, we dealt with them for about 4 or 5 months while I was still there, would probably be very positive about our relationship. The firefighters, because I'm a city manager, not because I'm Don Epley, would raise some concerns. I think they'd be philosophical ones. However, we had a good relationship and we were able to work quite well, other than some of the philosophical issues that came to a head.
No, I know what the problem is.
Right.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Smith.
Mr. Epley, I'm not really concerned about what you do in the evening or on Saturday or Sunday. I'm very concerned about what you do in your job. So I want you to reiterate your statement about possible conflicts of interest and that you either do or do not see any future activity which may be indeed be in conflict with your position.
Very simply, I would not wish to be in conflict from my own standards and see no possibility of that situation.
Mr. Chairman, I...
Mr. Baum, can I ask you a question before you do?
Yeah.
You know, I want you to understand, I'm not trying to tell Mr. Epley how to run his life, but I'm trying to talk to him about the fact that you talk about a conflict of interest, as I understand it, a monetary issue. But I think that any person that comes to the head of the personnel division in this state that has the responsibility of being the personnel director for 30,000, 40,000 state employees should devote his full energies to that job. And what I'm concerned about, not if he has a conflict monetarily, but if he's got the time commitment and the dedication to the personnel division to sit there in the evening, because that is not a 40-hour-a-week job. It's not a 5-day-a-week job. That is a full-time job that's going to take him every free moment he has. And if he doesn't know that, then he doesn't know much about that position.
I guess you see that my thought is that he serves at the pleasure of the governor, and if he isn't doing his job, he's going to be removed, and while you and I are in Eugene and Burns doing our thing, he's going to be working, we not knowing what he's actually doing. Now, if they don't know what he's doing and he doesn't do his job, he ought to be fired.
Or we should fire the governor.
Or
is that a motion? Did you have a motion, Senator?
But, you know, to monitor him day and night, I think is...
No, Bob, all I'm worried about is if he's got an entity out here that's still a viable business entity, and I think we're kidding ourselves, if he intends to still be a consultant, it puts him in a competing interest situation of where he's going to put his energies at, and whether it's going to be in the personnel division or whether it's going to be in urban management resources, and not necessarily because he intends to be insidious about it, it's just a selection
of what he wants to do.
I made him reiterate the statement.
But I just want to understand what I understand the conflict to be, not just monetarily. And I think Mr. Epley knows very well from the position he's been in with the city manager what I'm talking about.
Senator, I'd like to assure you that if you were to check back on my career, I've put considerable energies into any place that I've been responsible for and would continue to do so. That's just the way I function.
Mr. Chairman, call for the question.
Okay. Question is called for. Senator Hanlon moves that we confirm the governor's appointment of Donald B. Epley as administrator of the Personnel Division. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hanlon?
Aye.
Senator
Smith?
Aye.
Senator Kroll?
Aye.
Senator
Wingard?
Senator
Kroll?
Aye.
Senator Groner? Aye. Motion is carried.
Mr. Chairman, before we leave, it is very important in our plans for the division, personnel division, in view of the time it's taken to select Mr. Epley, that we proceed as quickly as possible. And we would consider it a favor if this matter could be pressed through the Senate as quickly as possible.
We'll send the report down this afternoon and have it on, we'll try and have it on Monday if at all possible.
Thank you very much.
And I'm sure if he doesn't do a good job knowing, having served with the governor for 20 years, he'd fire him.
He wouldn't be here if he didn't think he would.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Sure.
How are you?
I think that we should have the Republican member of our committee carry that. Would you care to carry his nomination?
I am the only.
Oh,
what about we? Oh, well, yeah, let me carry it. I am the
We'll tell George that.
Okay. Okay, as a courtesy to Senator Smith, we're going to return. Turn quickly to Senate Bill 710, and as the statutory rate, farm rate, and
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that it. The bill states 1250. I move it be changed to 1450.
Senator Smith moves that the rate for farmers be changed from 1250 to 1450, which is the present rate.
Mr. Chairman, let me speak just momentarily to that issue. As you recall, I requested some information from SAFE regarding the activity in the past 2 years at the 1450 statutory rate. I have that information before me. Briefly, what it says is that in the past 2 years, they've had less incidence of injuries in the 006 category, which now has been broken down into several, but I'm talking generally about 006, the old 006 total situation. The actual costs in the past 2 years have been $1,240, and if you take the 1450 rate, statutory rate, it has produced a substantial surplus to SAFE. You recall when we went from 850 to 1250, it was determined that there was about $1 million lost to the fund at that time. We went to 1250. From that time to this, we have replaced the $1 million loss, and we are now operating at 1450 without subsidy from anyone for any purpose or anything. So, Mr. Chairman, there is plenty of room for additional kinds of problems that we may foresee in the next 2 years, that is, increased injuries or something like that. There's plenty of room between the 1240 cost and the 1450 rate. So I move the bill. You have a question?
Yeah. Bob, you meant at 1250 we had made up the loss.
Yes.
You said 1450.
Well,
under 1250 we've picked up, we're...
No, we were at 1450. We've been at 1450 since last session. The past 2 years, we've been at 1450. I said that when we moved from 850 to 1250, the fund lost $1 million. from the 1250 to the 1450 rate. Prior to that, we picked up the million. Now we're with the less of the injury factor. The actual cost for the past 2 years was 1240, which indeed did increase again the surplus to the fund. Running, if we assume the same injury problems in the next 2 years, we will continue to add surplus to the state fund at the 1450 rate.
So this bill is before us because it was terminated.
That's right. It runs for 2 years at a time.
Okay.
As would this.
As this does.
Okay. Senator Smith moves that we amend the Senate Bill 710 by deleting 1250 on line 10 of the bill and substituting 1450 per $100 of payroll. Clerk will call the roll on the motion.
Senator Hammond?
Aye.
Senator Hammond?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Stroll?
Aye.
Senator Wingard?
Aye.
Senator Brunner?
Aye. Motion is carried. Senator Smith now moves that we send Senate Bill 710 to the floor as amended. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hammond?
Aye.
Senator Hammond?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator
Wingard? Aye.
Aye. Motion is carried. Senator Smith will carry the bill. We are pleased to have with us today the Attorney General of this state. So we're going to Senate Bill 228, which is on work session. Do you want to bring anybody up here with you to help you?
Right.
Right. Vic Levy, we had presented this bill to the committee earlier and then
with some amendments last time, which I understand were really hand gross bill with the amendments, and as near as I know, they've had a whole hearing on it. So we're here in case there are any questions. This would use the Administrative Procedures Act for wage claim, and the general theory behind it is to simplify the process and save some money in processing these wage claims.
Mr. Chairman,
before we go any further, I'll entertain a motion. Senator Klunagoski moves we take 228 off the table. Are there any objections? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, staff, is the mock-up copy of the bill we're going to be talking about?
Yeah.
My lawyer is here, so we're
what is it? Have these been adopted? Amendments in here yet?
No.
Chairman, I move the adoption of the amendments.
Senator Klunagoski moves the adoption of the amendments.
What amendments, Mr. Chairman?
That are in the mock-up bill.
They're in the front of in chapter in front of the bill.
The Senator Klungoski moves with we adopt amendments to Senate Bill 228, and that's the mocked-up version. Are there any questions? If not, clerk will call the roll on the adoption.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion is carried. Okay. Jim, you want to follow through or your counsel there?
I think we, you know, explained the bill and the amendments to the committee last time. Vic, do you have any?
Vic, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Vic, the measure summary that's on the front of 228 has to do with it, the way that it originally was proposed. Why don't you, in your own words, with your amendments, tell us what the measure summary is going to be now?
Okay. What we've done is we've altered the post determination process for taking the order in its final form and using a very simple system, which is also used by, I believe, the health division for getting that judgment in effect, making it a judgment lien, so that it's then subject to being executed upon the same as if a judgment had been rendered.
Are there any further questions? Do you have anything further on the bill?
Vic, have you been in contact with the Labor Commissioner's office on this bill?
Yes, we've been.
Are they in agreement with it?
Yes. We work with the Labor Commissioner's office throughout the entire bill.
Seems like everyone is in agreement.
Chairman, I move to the floor.
Okay, Senator Klungoski moves Senate Bill 228 to the floor as amended. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion is carried. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We did hear from the Attorney General from Wyoming, who has just left Oregon after spending the evening with you, and he told me to tell you he felt very fortunate to escape with his life.
Vic, after hanging out with the Attorney General from Wyoming, I was fortunate to escape with mine.
You notice he waited until after his bill was passed to make that comment?
Yeah. He feels safe after he gets a bill out of committee.
Do you want to take 870 or do you want to go to this 24? That was a simple one that we can take care of just to get it in.
There's only one here. Paul, do you want to come forward? I think we can do this quickly on Senate Bill 270.
240,
rather. And,
this is the one we're basically going to ask to have things in. And also, we would take the AG off the sponsorship because it's going to be a new bill.
Okay. This would be a new bill, or we'd have to amend 240, and the Attorney General would have their sponsorship removed, I would presume.
Right. Yeah, I talked with Mr. Redden and also with Ross Laybourne from the Consumer Protection Division, and assuming that 240, since it has been tabled, this is a bill that deals with automobiles, but it's franchising.
The same as it germane?
It's germane.
Romaine
and germane.
Okay. Go ahead and tell us your problem.
First, you want to move to 240.
Yeah. I'd like a motion to take 240 off the table. Senator Hannon, opposed? Are there any objections? Hearing none, it is so ordered.
The bill, the amendment, what we're asking for is for it to be printed as 240 and come back so we could have a hearing on it, and deals with franchise protection in the new franchise.
Do you have a copy or the bill or of the
I
amendment?
Believe everybody has a copy of the proposed amendments to Senate 240.
I have the book right in front of your bill.
propose to do is, when it comes up for a hearing, bring in people to testify on the merits of it at that time.
Yeah, this, what we do is propose to have these amendments.
Move the amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator Hannon moves the amendments. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hannon?
Aye.
Senator Hannon?
Aye.
Senator Smith? Senator Cole?
Aye.
What about the title on it? The motion is carried. Aye, Groner votes aye. What about the title?
The title of the bill should be relating to automobiles. And I have checked with legislative counsel over and over again. It's germane. You can amend the relating to clause.
And they will prepare a new title?
They will prepare a new title.
Okay. That's all we need, and we'll have a hearing on that at a later date. Let's go to Senate Bill 8.
Thank you.
That should be a motion to send it to be engrossed.
Okay.
Okay,
we'll take a motion to have it be engrossed. Senator Trow?
A.
A engrossed. A engrossed or B engrossed?
B, A engrossed.
Okay, fine. Senator Trow moves. Are there any objections? Hearing none, it is so. Let's go to Senate Bill 870. Team Maudlin with the Oregon Beauty Schools Association, the Oregon Hairdressers Association. Bob Davis, do you want to come up? Is Bob here? Does he want to come up too? Or
he's out in the hall.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Gene Maudlin. I'm at 1696 State Street, Salem. I work for Bob Davis of Public Affairs Council. I'm representing both the Oregon Beauty Schools Association and the Oregon Hairdressers and Cosmetologists Association. The legislative committees of both groups have endorsed Senate Bill 870. The bill is not complex. It simply allows a beauty salon or barbershop employee to display a certificate of practice in any conspicuous place within the shop rather than at a workstation. The way beauty salons are emerging physically, it is not convenient to always have the certificate at the workstation. I have been told of times when the certificate was attached to the back of the customer's chair and actually to the leg of the chair in one case. Two other reasons for the bill to be passed also exist. One is that hairdressers do not always use the same workstation. Work schedules change, and some will rotate from station to station depending upon the time or day of the week. It is an unnecessary burden for a hairdresser to carry the certificate from place to place from time to time. Bartenders and cocktail waitresses and waiters do not face the same requirement. Their license need only be posted in a conspicuous place. Doctors do not face this requirement. They may post their licenses in their private offices, which many patients will never enter. Doctors do not need to move their licenses from the cold marble bench in room A to the paper-covered pallet in room B and then to consultation room C, where there are no magazines to read and no licenses either.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gruogoski.
Unless there's something else, I'd move this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I would like to ask him a few questions.
Oh, go right ahead. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
I can... may I show you one of those?
It's really getting quite eloquent. It might be
more eloquent, but we got a number of bills that we'd like to...
Is that presented to the...
No.
Is that their license?
This is a license with a school diploma, and it's very difficult to...
Now, the license, as I understood it, it was explained to me, the reason you didn't want the license, the beauty parlors are taking care of men's hair now, and that they... That some of these men look at their address and this license and attempt to call on them.
That has happened.
Okay. As I understand it, why not...
I'm not guilty.
Why not put a piece of scotch tape over their address? I'll leave it there.
It is permitted to use like a felt tip pen and cover the
Well, that creates a problem, though. And I understand the board...
Yeah, but then I couldn't find out what the address was. That would create a problem.
Is there any problem, I mean, in that? Why? What's the real problem of posting their license? That's the only reason that I heard that they were opposed to posting their license.
Well, as I've tried to say, the way the beauty salons are physically emerging these days, they're not. You don't always have a big booth. You may have a chair out in an open space.
Well, you don't have to pack that. That over to the chair in the open space. The license stays at their station, I would presume.
But that is their station.
well, they have some, I would imagine that it's just in the vacant chair right in the middle of the room there. They have a wall or something they can put their license on. Why, what's the real reason behind that? And would it be possible to have someone that was unlicensed work if the license is not showing?
It is possible to have somebody unlicensed work now if he just says, I'm that person.
Well, we might have to have their picture on there. Okay. We also had objections here from the superintendent of schools.
On this? It's on the next bill.
It's on this one. Superintendent of schools.
No, the representative says...
He was opposed to staff taping the address.
Oh, that was a minimum number. All right, go ahead. Senator Kulongoski moves it.
The bill.
Senate Bill 870 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hanlon?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried.
Thank you.
Senator Crowe, you've had more experience along with the city school. I'm going to ask you to carry that bill.
Oh, I'd be delighted. Thank you.
Senate Bill...
That's how he gives me all the biggies.
Big one. 871. Bob Davis.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Bob Davis. I'm here representing the Oregon Beauty Schools Association. I also have a bill of great magnitude and importance. I guess I shouldn't really say that because it is important to the schools who have asked that the bill be introduced, and we appreciate the committee's action in causing it to be introduced. The bill simply says that in order for a school to open, that they shall have 20 enrolled students. Behind this, is the necessity for this bill is primarily that we believe that that number of students are necessary in order to maintain the staff and to provide the education that the students are entitled to when they do sign up and go to school. This was the situation for a number of years under the new and was the recommendation of the advisory committee to the Department of Education. The Department of Education changed the rule to or the recommendation to require that there be 20 workstations rather than 20 enrolled students. Apparently on the thought that if you made the investment in having the capital investment in having the workstations, that that would be sufficient to be sure that there were 20 students, and which would provide the personnel necessary to conduct to provide the education that's necessary. The schools do believe that there should be 20 students in order to have enough staff to provide an adequate education. So it's simply to put into place what has existed for a number of years. That's all I can say about it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Bob, I might express a concern that is it conceivable that up to 19 students could be tied by contract for an indefinite period to a school that may or may not become licensed to operate as a result of this? They have a contract for 19 students. Could be tied by a contract for an indefinite period.
It couldn't open? I don't know. I don't see that as a...
Aren't there schools that could have, say, below 20 now and have a contract to... would this terminate, this bill terminate it now, or would they allow...
No, this applies to schools opening up, and if the school could not provide the education, the contract could be terminated. It wouldn't... their contract to go to that school, if it can't provide the education, can't be licensed, can't open, the contract would be voided by the student.
Senator Crowe, do you have a...
Yes. Will this provision get in the way of any existing schools? Keep them from operating?
I can't answer that. I think that there has been a school that has opened with 4 students. But I think I'd better back off that. I'm not that sure, Senator Troy, and I would not want to...
Will it affect any of the schools that we grandfathered in last session when we passed the legislation?
No.
All of those schools would still be allowed to operate because
yes.
they're large enough, is that
yes.
what you're saying?
Yes.
If they were not large enough, would it affect them? If they were not large enough?
No, I think they'd still be grandfathered in.
So you don't see that this will change that particular
no.
provision?
No.
Okay. As I recall the legislation last time, it set up the kind of curriculum for schools, things that they should offer, the kinds of things that should be taught there. And that seemed to be the quality control rather than the song. I wondered why you want to go to having a number of students
to regulate
rather than
well,
the curriculum being
yeah.
the quality control.
Because the number of students, in order to meet the quality of the requirements now of the Department of Education, of which we strongly approve. We believe it's necessary to have that many students in order to justify the staff that is necessary to provide that education. It's a losing proposition otherwise.
But why not just let the market determine that then? If they have 16 students and they can't afford to have them, they're going to operate. They can't meet the curriculum. So why do this?
It's a valid argument.
As I understand, Bob, there are 4 schools as of April 79 that would fall under this provision and have less than 20 students. Now,
that may be that, but I know of only one.
Would this bill grandfather them in? They're doing business now, or would it apply to any school that is attempting to?
No, it would not grandfather in those who were not grandfathered in by the bill 2 years ago. That was the way I understood
sure.
the question.
I'm not sure these 4 were grandfathered in when the bill passed 2 years ago. I don't know if there's anyone here. Are they new schools?
We have some people in the audience who know.
Would you come up forward and give your name for the record and sit there?
My name is Wendell Curry. I'm the coordinator of private vocational school licensing for the Department of Education. There are, at the last count, 4 existing schools of hair design licensed under ORS Chapter 345 that are operating with less than 15 students. And it would appear to us that this provision would not only apply to new schools, but to the annual issuance of renewal licenses.
Right.
And as such, it would
on the renewal of the license, I would
right.
assume. They yes. couldn't renew, they, well, correct me if I'm wrong, would this apply to schools if they, when their license comes up for renewal, they'd be unable to renew it if they, providing they didn't have 20 students?
I'm advised so, yes.
Okay, so they could operate until their license expired.
But I am not an attorney, but I'm advised that that is...
They'd try and rustle and find 4 more students or whatever they need to. Senator Troll?
My impression was, and I carried the bill last session that set this procedure up, and we had another bill, another committee related to this, and I think you all were there
yeah.
at that time. My impression is that the kind of curriculum that we prescribed in that language last time really sets the quality for these schools, and you're supposed to look at those schools from the standpoint of that curriculum, aren't you?
That's correct.
Now, it doesn't seem to me like the size of the class is all that important. It's the curriculum and how well the students are being taught. And if it's not economic to have fewer than 20, well, then that's the school's problem. But I don't think it should be a licensing problem.
Senator, the rules speak to a required pupil-teacher ratio.
Oh, okay.
And which, in my opinion, I think should be adequate for...
Okay, and you're meeting that now. These schools meet that requirement.
That is correct.
They meet that requirement. Are they meeting the curricular requirements? Do you find those schools to be acceptable schools?
Yes, our specialist has been making recent visits to the schools and are finding that they are meeting.
The only thing wrong with those schools would be that they're too small to meet this requirement and this act.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, I don't think I can support this act.
What, Bob, do you have anything further to say? I mean, as far as the need for this bill, is it the feeling of your people that they're not doing an adequate job, these that have students?
Yes, and I think, to be candid, I believe that there are only so many people who are interested in this type of education, and if you distribute them in schools having less than an economic unit to provide the quality of education needed, that the whole system, they believe, collapses, and what they believe that... That 20 is a reasonable amount to provide the quality of education, meet the requirements of the state board or of the Department of Education, which again I must say we strongly support what they have done and believe that they're doing a good job.
Okay, are there any further questions? If not, do you wish to take any action on this bill today?
Chair, I'm sorry. How many? In answer to the question that was asked about how many people would go out of business with this?
There were four.
More than all that?
I don't know. Do you know where the... You could tell us...
Yes, Senator. As I recall, the Dalles School of Beauty
Eugene?
Boy. No, not in the Eugene. No, these Pendleton, the Dalles, those are two of them.
Independent.
Klatskanine.
Where did you
say? In Corvallis.
McMinnville, I believe, was the third one, and East West College in Portland is the fourth one. That's the newest licensed school.
Are there... Go ahead, Senator Smith.
Have these people been notified about this bill? You know?
We have alerted our advisory committees, the legislative advisory committees, to the contents of these bills, and we've also sent mailings of the minutes of the meetings where these were discussed to the schools.
There's been no opposition from any of the schools.
No one here?
No, sir. There has not.
They
the only
the
opposition,
business, but they want the law to put
the up. Only opposition has come from the advisory school, the advisory committee that represents the other diversified schools, and they took an action, acted on a motion to advise the superintendent to oppose the bill as not being in the best interest of the public.
Could I ask you? The four schools that you listed, let me just take them down, and I've got two questions to ask you of each one. The first one is, how many students are there in each of these four schools, the Dalles?
Two of them specifically, and I talked with our specialist about this yesterday, two of them specifically have 15.
Do you know which two of those are?
The Dalles is one, and I believe that McMinnville is the other, and I believe one of the schools has 12. Now, I don't want to
What's
be
the
held
other?
Specifically to that number, but and then one in Portland, the newest school, I think is about 6 or 7 students.
Now, that's my second question, is to ask you how long these schools have been in existence, and let me start with the Dalles.
I'm sorry, I can't tell you that. I've been with the program now for 2 years, and they were in existence long before that.
But
so they weren't grandfathered in by the previous legislation.
All of these schools were licensed under Chapter 691 when it was administered by the Board of Barbers or the Board of Cosmetic Therapy, and then became licensed under Chapter 345 when we got them in.
Let me ask you, would you be opposed to what Senator Trost is talking about, a grandfather clause on these four that are left?
No, I think this is just bad legislation, that's all. Why, what's the smallness is, you shouldn't exclude anybody from smallness.
I just understand what he's trying to get at.
Well, it's just a bad legislation. We've got a quality control, it's student-teacher ratio and the curriculum, and that's the quality control.
Senator, we have a second concern, and that is that when students are enrolled in a school under the law, when they are enrolled, they are signed to a tuition agreement. And it's a binding agreement, really.
So who's liable would be with the state that won't license these schools?
Well, I would think that, as Mr. Davis indicated, if the school couldn't be licensed, those contracts would become null and void. But it appears to us that those contracts are good up until the time that that school either gives up trying to be licensed or has achieved its 20 enrolled students. And that could be weeks, months. And in the meantime, the students are tied.
I have nothing further, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, well, that's bad. I just want to hear it today.
Any further questions? Do I hear a motion one way or the other? If not, why are the hearing is closed on this bill? Let's go to Senate Bill 392. Bill Fritz will have Cliff Allison and Mr. Hannon, or Senator Hannon, you were on that subcommittee.
Well, as we reported last time, Mr. Chairman, Roy Green and others participated in the subcommittee, and we were able to come up with some amendments to the bill that met with general approval of those participating, except on one point, and that is regard to the so-called surplus line insurers, non-admitted carriers. The insurance commissioner opposed the proposition that the self-insured groups be allowed to purchase reinsurance from these so-called surplus line carriers. Mr. Green did not agree with that. I suggested that that particular battle ought not to be fought out over this bill. I think the bill itself is important enough that we ought to get on with it. And I would certainly recommend that we not allow this bill to founder on a difference of opinion between the insurance commissioner and some others. I think the bill is before us is in good shape, unless there have been some further amendments. Rocky?
At last work session, Senator Gruner asked me to meet with insurance commissioner Bill Fritz.
Bill, I think Bill should come up here too, and
Roy Green. And at this meeting, we talked about two basic issues. One was whether or not to allow non-admitted insurance carriers to carry excess insurance, and two, whether or not to access differently groups. self-insurers versus individual self-insurers, and both the insurance commissioner and the workers' comp department has come forth today with each with their set of amendments. And I think they would both want to speak on those.
Are those the amendments that worked out? Were worked out in subcommittees, Senator?
Last time.
These are extra.
These are
staff
extra.
Met with these people, so I'm not familiar with the two sets of amendments that he talked about.
I think if there were other sets of amendments that Senator Hanlon, who was chairman of that subcommittee, should have had an opportunity to work with him rather than bring him before the committee at this time. Were you notified that there were other amendments coming, Senator?
Today.
So, you want to go through these. I think unless we'll probably put it back in subcommittee and see if it, so you can take a look at it.
Well, Chairman, we've been through several subcommittees, and my recommendation originally was this question of non-insurers or non-admitted carriers would have to be settled here in full committee. I'm not sure anything to be accomplished by going back to subcommittee again.
Cliff, you want to lead off on?
Just, I'd rather have Mr. Young, but Senator, just in the way of explanation, the revised amendments that were adopted by this committee initially were not in proper legislative form. We did that as a draft to work from, and we worked from that and adopted it. So we went to the Legislative Council to put it in the proper form. At the time, we found out that when we were amending some of the sections, there were reference to other sections that we had not cleaned up. And in addition, we wanted to add this one aspect of making sure that we could assess the groups as a class and self-insured employer individually as a class if needed to be in a self-insured adjustment reserve. So what you have basically is that we have submitted to this committee a Legislative Council Amendment draft, which is 5379, Senate Bill 392-2, which incorporates the amendments that you previously adopted and adds some additional amendments. And I would ask Mr. Young to explain those.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Larry Young, Minister of the Compliance Division of the Department. Changes to those amendments adopted by the committee on 5-1 beginning with page 1, line 4, after 656.434, we add 656.506, 656.614, and 656.636. On page 4, line 20, section 3, is the old section 4 that was adopted by the committee. On page 5, line 9, after the word employers, we delete the words as a, and on following that on line 10, add or any group, or in the same line, delete an assessment computed as in ORS 656612. Then on line 11, add thereof, comma, assessments. The purpose of this amendment is, as stated, to enable the director to assess the individual self-insured employers and the self-insured employers as a group, depend upon their experience.
Now, that's a substantive change, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And that's one of the new amendments resulting
that's
from
correct.
The most recent.
Well, where's that?
On page 5.
Page 5, lines 9, 10, and 11.
Of the amendment. Yes.
Then I might point out, Senator, that really is the only substantive change that we have made to your amendments that you have adopted.
Uh-huh.
The rest of it is the principally conforming amendments and cleaning up the other sections that are not needed.
Okay.
The next amendment to those adopted by the committee begins on line 23 of page 5, section 4, is the amendment to ORS 656636. The deletions beginning on page 6, on line 11 going through line 25 is taken out as because in the previous section we deleted the direct responsibility employers adjustment reserve and created the self-insured employers reserve. So all the references from those sections deleted are not necessary because of the elimination of the direct responsibility employers adjustment reserve. On page 7, in with line 1, because of the previous deletions of the two previous subsections, subsection 4 has been changed to subsection 2. The next change is on page 8. Line 3, or 656506, has been amended. The amendment begins with line 7, and deleting 3/4 of the money so deducted from the workers' wages shall be placed in the retroactive reserve as provided by subsection 4 of ORS 656636. This was taken out because it is no longer subsection 4, and because 656636 already makes the reference to the distribution of the employer assessment monies. And on the last page, page 9, the section 6 was previously section 3 of the rule, of the amendments adopted by the committee.
What we did is reorganize the sections a little bit based on legislative council to, and that's all. But the substantive change, as you pointed out, Senator, was the subclass and class.
Bill, what you added something to it. What was your problem with it, Bill?
We recommended to Senator Hamlin and Roy Green concurred. We recommended, I think, two substantive changes. One is that a form of a guarantee fund be established, which has been taken care of by these amendments. The guarantee fund of the self-insurers was to be divided into two forms. One, the large companies would be establish a guarantee fund, and Roy concurred in that for the large companies. And a guarantee fund established for the smaller employers to be assured that there would be sufficient funds in the event of insolvency. Roy Green concurred in that, and we also concurred in that. The other change that the department recommended dealt with the companies who would be eligible to write the excess coverage. We felt that in the safeguard that should be built into this bill, that the admitted market or admitted carriers be restricted to be the only ones to write the excess coverage.
Well, workers' comp alone, this applies.
Workers' comp alone. Now, conceitedly, we may have the authority under the present insurance code to deal with that particular problem, because basically in surplus line, no agent is supposed to place business with a non-admitted carrier in this state as so long as there is a available market. Currently, we have 12 admitted insurers in the state who are interested and who will write the excess coverage for the grouping of the self-insurers, and we have, I think, 10 surplus line or non-admitted carriers. Our basic concern...
Let me ask you this. What if you can't get an admitted carrier, won't take it? What does this say?
That, then they are... If you cannot get an admitted carrier, then you are free to go to the surplus line.
Were the provisions of this bill?
They are not in this bill, but they are in the surplus line law.
You suppose... Would the surplus line law apply to this bill?
Not under the language that we currently have in the bill. We had anticipated that the large self-insurers would present argument to this committee, and I assume they will, to the effect that they be grandfathered to this particular clause. I'm certain that some of the larger self-insurers like Weyerhaeuser, Georgia Pacific, deal directly with London and have capable, experienced people who are negotiating contracts for them.
I've heard that concern, yeah.
We have no concern with them being grandfathered. We fully expected them to come forward and offer an amendment to you to the effect that they be grandfathered.
Should we have a grandfather clause on here, then, that would take care of the...
I personally think there should be, yes, because I think they're big boys, and they're capable of handling their own.
And negotiating an international market for this type of coverage.
Where I am concerned is basically with the new types that are going to be coming into the self-insured market, because we have no handle, we have no voice. There's nobody in this state, not the governor, not Roy Green, not the Senate, and not the legislature, not the insurance commission, have any control or voice over the surplus line riders that are not in the United States. So consequently, we are concerned, and that is why we've offered the amendment requiring them to write in the admitted market, because we have some control.
The small employers would have less sophistication as far as the market.
That's right.
Yeah,
the large companies, they have experienced insurance managers who negotiate their contracts for them. The second thing that concerned us was the fact that we have absolutely no voice or control in the price that could be charged eventually. I don't know what the price is going to be for the excess coverage in the non-admitted market, but we have no control over it. They could tell us to drop dead, which they did at on one occasion. We attempted to as a general rule, to require the reinsurers, the American Re and General Re and some of the others, to notify the insurance departments when they cancel a reinsurance contract with any admitted carrier. They opposed that and said, go to hell, in effect, if you put this thing through and require it, we're moving to the Bahamas, and let's see you try and get some jurisdiction or control over us there. So consequently, those are the things that are motivating us, is the solvency of, and nobody has any voice or control over the surplus line market. Secondly, the inadequacy of price control that may evolve in charging for the excess coverage. Third, the capitalization, for instance, of a surplus line writer is less than a third, or is approximately one third of what we require the admitted market to have. In other words, I think you can organize a surplus line company for about $500,000, whereas to write workman's compensation in this state, a minimum of $1.5 million is required. So consequently, we put those recommended that the excess coverage be restricted to admitted markets, and we would have no objection to a grandfather clause to those companies that currently are in the surplus line.
A grandfather clause, all we would need is a grandfather clause to grandfather those in that are self-insured at the present time, would appear to me would take care of it, and because they're all big boys.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Senator Hanlon.
Bill, have we had any trouble with the surplus line carriers?
Not with the legitimate ones, no. The ones at the Princess Lloyd's of London are very reputable, and I have never known Lloyd's of London to breach a contract, and I have known a very few instances. Eddie Zorn, who controls the surplus line market in this state, has done an excellent job of keeping his fingers on these particular companies, and he has done an excellent job of excluding them when he feels that they are not financially capable of writing.
Why won't that condition continue to exist then?
Because Eddie Zorn can't do any more than to opinionate or tell them that they can't write. But there is no legal way that we can attack or get in touch or force them to honor their contracts. And I have fear of unscrupulous developments occurring, particularly in the Bahamas, or as we call the offshore companies. The minute they find out that this is available, I anticipate there will be formation of companies down there. And then it becomes Eddie's sole responsibility to make a determination of are they good or are they bad. And the other aspect is pricing. I don't know what is going to happen to the price of the excess coverage if we don't have some restricted to the admitted market.
Cliff, your department at several points in this bill assumed a certain supervisory controlling power. Do you recall if there's anything in here that would give you a handle on advising or permitting or not permitting these people to buy surplus insurance with any particular company? That's power in here for you anywhere?
Not to my knowledge.
We
can, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Senator, we can approve the types prescribe the types and approve the retention limitation level.
Can you determine the carrier?
There's no provision for us to.
Well, would you? Go ahead. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Ask the question.
The commissioner's amendment then?
Mr. Chairman, the area we're talking about is on page 2, starting with line 4. Actually, starting with line 1, an insurer authorized to do business in the state or with any other insurer from whom such insurance can be obtained pursuant to 744-305 and 744-405.
That is now, eliminated according to
is being recommended. Now, the department's position is that we want the requirement of excess insurance coverage. There is the people who are presenting the bill has objections to that deletion, and that is for them to address their concerns and for the insurance commissioner.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you very much for those people he speaks of to give the committee their reasons why they would oppose the deletion of this language.
Yeah. You object to the deletion of this language. The department would object to the deletion of this language starting in line 4 then. Mr. Roy Green, the chair of the Workman's Comp Board, is in favor of the amendment restricting the market to admitted carriers.
Bill, when did he change his mind?
He didn't. That was his testimony before you, Senator.
As I recall, he...
We discussed the possibility of a grandfather clause for the existing carriers. And
Mr. Chairman?
Just a minute, Senator Hannon is handling.
It's possible that I misunderstood. No. I thought Roy Green was...
I understood
him to say that he was not concerned about purchase of such insurance from the surplus line carrier.
Rocky, do you have any recollection?
I don't recall.
We're not, Senator, we're here not taking a position on this particular section, but I think the commissioner and chair pointed out the problem if you don't have the non-admitted lines, and also pointed out the problem for all having and his concern is, Mr. Green, unfortunately, could not be here today.
Well, I think his concern is well taken, but
And it is well taken, but the amendments that we proposed, we did not incorporate what Mr. Fritz recommended in the amendment, with the understanding that he would be presenting that amendment to the committee today, which he is doing. And as to your specific question here, if my understanding is what insurance, if I may, Bill.
No.
What the insurance commissioner is recommending that a period be inserted on line four after states, and that or with any other insurance from such insurance can be obtained pursuant to RS 744-305 to 744-405 be bracketed out.
Yeah.
So that you would have your first sentence with any insurer authorized to business in the state. He pointed out the problem of the non-admitted carriers who are already in the state with certain self-insured. And this was the problem that Roy is concerned about is those that are already have non-admitted excess coverage.
Well, if you grandfather them in, that takes care of the problem.
Yes, sir. We don't
this
have
doesn't
a grandfather.
Well,
I know, but we intend to put a grandfather clause on
that
here.
That would take care of
that
the...
Would,
be,
yeah. Would that take care of Roy's objections?
Well,
if you want an amendment.
We're not really objecting. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman?
Ours...
Wait a minute. Senator Klugas.
Mr. Chairman, the only problem I have is I'm more... I've listened to Senator Hanlon say what he thought what was going on, and I'm going to rely upon him, and I am somewhat reluctant to have the other people from the department tell me what Mr. Green thinks. I would be much more concerned, I mean interested, if in fact that we just wait until Roy can be here and in fact have him come before the committee and tell us yes or no what his intentions were. And I'm relying upon I feel much more comfortable relying upon Senator Hanlon, but I see the other members of the department shaking their head no, and I think Roy should be here to clarify.
I would appreciate it, Senator Hanlon, if you would, if you could get your subcommittee together again and go
all
over
right.
this and see if you can straighten it out.
Okay.
You've done a lot of work on this already rather than bring it before the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to hear from this Mr. Vanatta.
We do have Mr. Zorn who traveled.
I think that we discussed this with Ms. Eddie Zorn prior to the meeting today, and I think what he has to say would be good as far as the committee is concerned, but we're taking care of his problem if we grandfather, I presume, if we grandfather those that are covered or self-insured now. Eddie, do you want to comment on that? Eddie Zorn, you want to come up and this was a concern you expressed to me prior to the meeting, and I thought that this grandfather clause should take care of this problem. If it doesn't, we'd like to hear about it. Dave, I want you to come up to here. Now we have a group here in the back. Would you like to introduce yourself? You have a spokesman for you. You're representing a group of junior citizens, I would assume. Teenagers. Well, we're glad to have you aboard.
What are they talking about now about this grandfather clause?
Well,
okay, glad to have you aboard.
Grandfather is an issue.
Eddie, do you want to, the one over to you or Dave, do you want to express yourself as far as what we've done and what we have contemplate doing if it would satisfy your problem with the self-insured?
Well, first let me say that this is the first time I've been on the opposite side
of the table of an insurance commissioner. But I really don't have a position on anything pertaining to the bill except this one thing that they're trying to do to it now, and that is take out that portion which pertains to eliminating the amount going, if any, to the surplus line market.
Okay. That's
the only issue I have.
Well, let me ask you this then. The testimony of the commissioner was that this applies to the self-insured now or the giants in the industry, the warehousers, the Georgia Pacific, and so on. That they would grandfather them in, the present ones are there. What he's concerned about is those that will come that are small, that are insured and not sophisticated, lack the sophistication of buying the insurance market. Obviously, the giants of the industry can negotiate with Lloyd's of London and get the best deal, perhaps. But this is why they want to confine those self-insured to the market which is approved by the insurance commissioner. Would this satisfy the people you represent?
Well, the people I represent object mainly to the fact that by having that in there, it indicates that the surplus line market is unreliable. That's the one thing we object to, having that wording in there. Maybe you haven't thought of it in that way, but that's one of the premises under which we are operating. We don't see the necessity of having such a wording in there when especially a good deal of your state properties are insured in the surplus line market. A good deal
by non-admitted companies are being
yes,
insured.
Because the admitted market can't handle it all. They won't. Let's put it that way. Maybe they can, but they won't. So a great deal of the non-admitted companies are writing your own state building. As a matter of fact, I think you're sitting in one of them. Because it's written in an overall policy covering lots of buildings.
Is what you're trying to tell this committee that the non-admitted companies are no danger if they were to write the surplus as far as workman's comp is concerned, or the self-insured that are going to be admitted that could come under this bill?
If the self-insurers, now listen to this carefully, if the self-insurers are such as they deserve to be self-insurers, then the admitted market should write it. But there's a possibility that there won't be enough admitted market to handle it, and you better be prepared to have somebody handle it. And there's even a possibility that the non-admitted market won't handle it if it's not the right type of insurance
that's
people that's
Senator
in there.
Hanlon's going to have to consider. Huh? This is something that Senator Hanlon's going to have to consider.
That's the main point. But a lot of people have an idea that the non-admitted market just writes anything. That's nothing further than from the truth, because they're just as fussy as any of the other companies.
I know they're terrible.
Huh?
They're not fussy, they're terrible.
Yeah. Now, but some of the things I was trying to, that I would like to bring out, if you give me the time, and that is this, that in the first place, the non-admitted market is not permitted to write any business whatsoever. Well, let me preface that by saying they're not allowed to compete with the admitted market. That's in your law book, and that's part of my job to see that they don't compete. They're not allowed to write business on rates less than what the admitted market writes. Now, I think you've gotten the impression, I'm led to believe that you got the impression that they go out and steal business from the admitted market. This is not the case. They must write it at rates that either the same or
in excess thereof. We as taxpayers contribute to the upkeep of the insurance department. In other words, they go into your general fund and take out so much money to operate. And I have a book here that you might look. I can't give it to you as an exhibit. You want to give it to me? That book is paid. You'd be very interested in it. And it has practically every alien company in it that writes business in this state. And that book is put out and approved by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, of which our commissioner and every commissioner in the United States is a member thereof. And the money that we pay into that association, which is the taxpayers' money, produces that book. And that's the book we follow on the companies that are now being ruled against, so to speak. And this is those are the things we object strenuously to. As far as the capital is concerned, the association for many years and still continues, we're not supposed to allow the surplus line companies to do anything that the non-admitted companies can do. So when the capital of the admitted market was increased here some years ago, and I believe it was increased from 500,000, which is the same as the surplus line companies are supposed to have, it was increased to 1 million. I don't recall it being increased to 1.5 million, but I won't bank on it, but I think it's 1 million. We follow exactly the same thing. No company has ever come into this state. I'm talking about surplus line company. No surplus line company is operating in this state with the capital of less than the capital of the admitted market is required.
Mr. Zerner, could I ask you a question in the form of trying to understand what you're saying? First of all, you said that the unadmitted market must charge the same rates as the admitted market by
law.
Okay. Secondly, you said that if there was a company in the unadmitted market that wasn't performing properly, the insurance commissioner of Oregon operating on the national board could bring that to the national board?
No, I didn't say that.
Well, what control does Oregon have over...
Well, let me give you an example. Can I give you an example?
See, the point is that that's what the insurance commissioner is
concerned
about.
And I'm disagreeing with him.
Well, I'm trying to find out what control Oregon has over the unadmitted market. Over an unadmitted insurance company in the state of Oregon.
All right. If you give me a chance, I'll give you a very good example. And these are people maybe you might know. In Klamath Falls here recently, the school district entered into a contract with a insurance brokerage house who has a surplus line license and placed that business in a surplus line company. The policy itself never reached my or incidentally, every policy that's issued in the surplus line market passes across my desk for approval or disapproval. This one didn't even reach my desk. Now, the commission on that policy, this was a Klamath Falls School District, which is a large premium and the commission is large. Naturally, the people that lost it, which was the Klamath Falls Agents Association, they screamed. You'd scream too, wouldn't you? And where'd they go? They went to the insurance commissioner. They didn't come to me. The insurance commissioner office, however, did come to me. And between the two offices, and mainly the insurance commissioner's office, an investigation was made. The charge was found to be true. And the insurance commissioner's office penalized a surplus line agent $5,000. This is only within the last 6 months. And put a probation on him that if he ever even thought of doing anything again, he'd lose his license. Now, if that isn't having some charge over it, I don't know what is. We had a case here not too long ago where a loss wasn't being paid. By who? By the Lloyd's of London, one of their little syndicates. That was handled by the insurance department, and it was collected. Now, I admit it came to me, and we helped. But the thing was handled by their investigating department. Now, I don't expect the insurance department commissioner to know everything that goes on in his office. When I was there, I don't think I knew everything that was going on. But I do know that they have the authority, can use it. And normally, if it's something that I can do myself, we do not use their help. But if we need be, we do. Matter of fact, they have one in their hands right now on a penalty on the payment of taxes. Was I collect, incidentally, among other things, I collect the state taxes on this type of business, only to be of assistance. And one wasn't paid in time, and there was a penalty. Their office is investigating this charge, not paying the penalty. So they're very close to the whole picture. That's why I say I'm very sorry. This is the first time in my life I ever took issue with the insurance department or the insurance commissioner, but I have to.
Mr. Chairman, it's good for them.
Now, another thing he said, one more thing, then I'll...
Okay, Eddie, we got... yeah? It's getting late.
Yeah, but one other thing he stipulated about reinsurance. Reinsurance of companies is not a surplus line piece of business. We have nothing to do with reinsurance of companies. If you remember,
Chairman,
you mentioned reinsurance.
Mr. Chairman,
yes, I would move that we adopt the amendments as presented by Cliff Allison, and that the bill be printed and brought back before the committee for
consideration.
Second the motion.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded that the bill be adopted, amended, as proposed by
Cliff Allison and his department, and they'll be printed and brought back to the committee for final action.
Yeah. Okay.
At which time we can hear from Mr. Green if he has some objection, which I believe is.
You heard the motion. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. All right. Motion is carried.
Mr. Thorne, before you just get away, you know, I was trying to listen to you, and I think you qualified your whole statement by about the first 10 words that you said, and I think you were trying to tell us something when you said self-insurers, if they deserve to be self-insured.
Mm-hmm.
What are you trying to tell me?
Well, that's a personal issue, I say. And this is what I meant.
That's part of the bill.
I've always been against fictitious group insurance. And I'm still against it. And to me, that's a fictitious group if there ever was, but taking people of different things and putting them together. Who's going to be responsible for what? Now, maybe you can do it under law.
We have it
in the other type, all other types of business.
I took it, what you mean to try to tell us that in providing coverage, whether they're admitted or non-admitted, that if they are self-insurers that don't deserve to be self-insurers, they're not going to get coverage. Is that what you're trying to tell us?
You want me to talk to you later on?
Yeah, why don't we do that? Because I'll just meet you outside and you can tell me, explain that to me.
Yeah, because there's lots to it that
the reason we did all this work here was to determine who deserved to be self-insured or not. We've been as careful as anybody can suggest.
We have to have so much capital and whatnot.
Requirements are quite stringent.
Surplus insurance and whatnot. Okay. Zorn, the former insurance commissioner.
What does he do?
He was always for the self-insured. He's with this, Zorn is with this surplus line group, I think.
No, I didn't.
Let's go to Senate Bill 496. I hope we can get through that quickly. Bill Wyatt.
Well, why don't I just present?
concerns with subcommittee.
Okay. What's that?
Is there a subcommittee amendments?
Okay.
Get the amendments.
Yeah.
I don't need him. I'll tell you what.
We have Senator Frugoski will present amendments to the bill.
Mr. Chairman, you assigned Senate Bill 496 to a subcommittee of which Senator Smith and I and you sat on. And Mr. Wyatt, there's a mocked-up version of the bill in your bill, in your bill book. And if you look in your bill book, it says, it's a mocked-up version of Senate Bill 496. It says OSCA Amendments 41179 and 42579. They were a series of amendments that were presented by the Oregon State Employees Association to better clarify the intent of exactly what they were intending to do when they set up the Oregon, what do they call it, the Oregon State Employees Benefit Board. Those are the amendments dated April 11th and April the 25th. The amendments on April 25th basically had to do with the composition of the board as far as how many members of management and how many members of the labor organization would be on it. And they attempted to set it up with an equal number of management and labor. I would, Mr. Chairman, for the sake of the discussion of the bill, I would move the amendments into the bill.
Okay, you've heard a motion to adopt the amendments proposed by Senator Frugoski, who chaired the subcommittee. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion's carried. Aye. Did you have anything further to present on the bill? I think that, is there a need for this? I think you said something about a need for this to go to Ways and Means.
Did I say that?
I did. Lansing, do you want a subsequent
Well,
bill?
Mr. Chairman, I think if you look at the impact statement, you find that there's some administrative costs involved of $100,000 to $200,000. And for that reason, I think that I would move that this bill be sent to Ways and Means Committee for that consideration of that problem.
Did you want to testify any, did you say anything on that, or Lansing? Why don't you both come up? You're both friends.
Chairman, we'll see how long that lasts.
Mr. Chairman, my name, for the record, is Bill Wyatt, representing the Oregon State Employees Association. Initially, I'm sure as you recall, the bill had a cost impact of approximately $6 million, which was a direct effect on a general fund. And as a result of the amendments you've adopted, that cost impact is no longer part of the measure. The fiscal impact referred to is not, in fact, a fiscal impact against the state. It is a fiscal impact against those who pay the premiums, because it is the a percentage of less than 2% of each premium dollar will be used to administer the fund, and that is the fiscal impact that we're talking about here.
Is that, does the Employee Benefit Board, do they still, is that what they receive now, this?
Correct.
For the cost of it? So it's the same thing, except
correct,
you would be getting the 2% for whatever he,
correct,
for your employees, so it's actually not costing the state,
that is correct,
any more than it's costing them now if they use the board exclusively.
Well, it doesn't cost the state anything anyway. They appropriate,
right,
a,
they appropriate a fund,
certain amount of money based on the negotiations underway, and then a percentage of that, less than 2%, is used to...
that's a formula.
The fund. That's correct.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
There's a gentleman here that I'd like to ask his opinion. Would you come up here and identify yourself and tell me who you are?
I'm Ralph Folt, the insurance manager for the Oregon State Employees Benefit Board. The law permits the Employees Benefit Board to charge up to 2% of the premiums paid to run the program. The board charges 0.5%. You can't say that the money doesn't come from the state because the state contributes up to 78. Right now, we're currently contributing 83.6% of the premium. The state of Oregon is. Of the total premium committed during the year. So when you say we have one half of 1%, the state is really contributing some of that money.
Maybe you wish to comment on that?
Well, what the state is contributing is an amount currently, as an example, $49, up to $49 for every employee who chooses to participate in the health insurance program. Now, that $49 is contributed because that's what the legislature appropriated and recommended by the executive department as a result of negotiations with the various unions. Now, the one half of 1% that Mr. Bolt referred to comes from that money. And I think one of the fundamental issues that is at stake in this legislation is simply that. I think you are aware that in negotiations, whatever you receive in fringe benefits is something you're not likely to receive as a salary. And so we regard that effectively as the employee's money.
Let me ask, I think to clarify this for the committee, is this going to cost, if we have these two boards, is this going to cost the state any additional money, any additional to what we're now paying?
Not unless the Committee on Ways and Means appropriates more money as a result of negotiations. This bill will not cost the state money.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, John Lansing, Blue Cross Association. I believe that the startup costs are to the magnitude that it's valid and to scrutinize whether or not this concept of the creation of a new board is really necessary. And secondly, in terms of insurance concepts and underwriting standards, anytime you split the risk, you're going to eventually end up with higher premiums because of greater health care utilization in certain groups. And in this particular bill, you're going to be splitting the risks, and in one group, you will find unorganizable units, executive department, legislative, and retirees. And to that degree, that insurance group, that insurance utilizer, is going to result in having to have to pay higher premiums within that group. So eventually the cost is going to be borne. Speaking for Blue Cross, our corporation is going to be competitively bidding on whichever group is designed by this body. But I think it's our position to point out that the cost of health care is going to increase potentially under this bill for the unit that's being split off.
Mr. Chairman,
I'd like to have another impact statement on the new bill the way it's marked up. And I can't get square in my mind whether it's going to cost any more money or not. But it's been amended, and I'd like to have an analyst go over it and tell me whether or not there is going to be.
Let's postpone the bill and we'll request a stamp.
That's fine. Some say it does and some say it doesn't. I don't know which is right or wrong.
I agree. Is that okay? We'll take action when we have that debate. Okay.
Okay.
We're not going to hear 504. In fact, that Roy Green tells me he can take care of that under existing law, and it was my bill, so.
Lay it on the table.
It's on the table already.
Oh, no. Which one's that, Chairman?
504. 504.